Welcome to Volume 7 in the series, Wasanich, The Saltwater People, with Robert Clifford. This series is dedicated to learning about the unique and rich history of the Wasanich Saltwater People and their traditional connection to their Salish Sea homeland, including Stais, South Pender Island. Robert Clifford is a member of the Sayout First Nation. He is an assistant professor at the Peter A. Allard School of Law at the University of British Columbia. He will speak about some of his PhD research, which explore the ways that Wasanich laws are generated by and reflect the values, philosophies, lands, and worldviews of the Wasanich people. He will also explain how the complexity of attempting to fit Aboriginal law into Canadian law has layers of challenging issues, and will provide insight by examining some of those issues. He will speak about what it means to take in traditional Wasanich stories and have a living relationship with them in order to make them a part of you. That and so much more. This recording was made in February of 2024 on the grounds of the Wasanich School Board. I am your host, Chris Wakalug, and it is my pleasure to present this series to you. This series is made possible with grants administered by the South Pender Historical Society. I would also like to thank my co-interviewer, Robert Dill, president of the SPHS. Without his help, this interview would not have been possible. Both of our voices have been extracted from this final audio in order to give maximum time and clarity to the interviewee to communicate and share their stories. Thank you for listening. Here is Robert Clifford's story.
My name's Rob Clifford. I also carry the name Yalquetza, which comes to me from my late grandfather, Earl Claxton Sr., so Claxton family. I live over and I'm from Sayout, Wasanich, obviously. My mom is Rebecca Clifford. She works here at the tribal school as well. My sister works here too, Rochelle Clifford. And my dad's Ray Clifford. And in this building here, like the old schoolhouse, my grandpa used to do a bunch of the language work in here and some of the other buildings. So yeah, very proud and honored to carry his name and to try and, I guess, follow in his footsteps in some ways, but doing my own work in my own kind of way. Right now I'm an assistant professor at the law school, Peter A. Allard School of Law, I guess they call it, at UBC. And I've been teaching there since 2020 I started. So during the pandemic, I taught online. I have a bit of an interesting setup that I teach a field course in Wasanich law as well. That brings UBC students and UVic students here to Wasanich territory. And I do that every second year. So I kind of rotate between going to Vancouver and teaching there and then coming and teaching here. But I guess the bulk of that work, minus the things that I teach in Aboriginal treaty rights and Indigenous settler legal relations and climate change stuff, really the bulk of what I do for my work and research is thinking about Wasanich law, what it means on its own terms, how we think about its revitalization, bringing back and resurging, I guess, that form of law and governance, but also what that means in terms of ongoing colonialism, right? It's not a straightforward question in terms of how you make space either within or outside of Canadian law for these different legal traditions to operate and to uphold their laws and jurisdictions. So that's one complicating factor. And then also climate crisis in terms of if you have certain responsibilities to place and to other beings, and you have this global web of climate crisis, climate change, things in the background, it's not a very straightforward question of how you deal with or manage all of that as well. So kind of a very local ground up and then a more global kind of perspective. It's where my research is. And then I, as mentioned, I do the field course where I bring students here and learn about our laws, culture, teachings, ways of being and whatnot. It's a land-based experiential course. it's a full credit load for the semester. So they do that Monday to Friday, 9 to 4 kind of thing for an entire term, going around our territory here with elders, knowledge holders and whatnot, and then working on some community projects or different initiatives that the community points out and is working on. And so we get some of law students using their skills and things they've learned to help further that along as well. So every second year I do that. I've done that twice through UBC now and once previously through UVic. So 3 times now I've run that course, and I love it. It's a great course. It's also a little bit of a tiring course. There's a lot going on. It's a lot of teaching hours, but that's one of the things I'm pretty passionate about in my teachings. It's I think a pretty important initiative to getting people to understand some of that. So in terms of how I came around to, I guess, law in general, I did an anthropology undergrad, actually, kind of a little bit by default. I applied a little bit late in my first year, and there's only so many things I could get into. I don't even think I really knew what anthropology was at the time. But I found some aspects of it, thinking about studying culture and people and whatnot, interesting. So I did that for my undergrad, and ended up applying at UVic. I just applied and I thought I'd see what happened and we'd go from there, and I ended up getting in. And so I had this idea in my head at that time, people had been saying, or that there'd be kind of a need for any of our people or more Indigenous people in general to go to law school and have law degrees and to help assert our rights and title and other things like that through Canadian law. So to protect our rights and interests. I went into law school thinking that that was my path. So essentially Aboriginal law. The distinction I make is Aboriginal law is like a branch of Canadian law that deals with Aboriginal peoples, Aboriginal issues and whatnot. It's Canadian law through and through, but it's just meant to help uphold rights, title and these other sorts of things. But that shifted along the way. I met John Burroughs, who became a good friend and mentor, and I started to think more and more about Indigenous and more specifically Kusanich people's own laws. So how could we see our own teachings, our own governance structures and whatnot as law, as our form of law and governance, and just seeing law in a very different way than most people assume or have come to think of law based on Canadian colonial law and kind of a imposition of a very particular way of seeing law and what it is that law does. So kind of a big broadening out moment in my law school studies where I thought, okay, I could do something different here. So I did go on to article and briefly practice at an Aboriginal law firm, but there was a moment where I got offered an associate position at the law firm and I got into a master's program, and it was a bit of there's a lot of different factors in terms of what you want your lifestyle and other things to look like. But there's also, for me, I think a big moment of, do you try and work from within something and to make these little smaller pushes or changes that might help uphold something in particular instances, which, you know, sometimes is needed and helpful? Or do you step back and think a bit of a bigger picture and, you know, question whether that system is doing a lot of the work of colonialism still, but allowing you to make certain gains, but funneling you down a particular path? And how might you think of things entirely differently? And that's the path I ended up choosing. And I guess it's to a certain level valuing more than another, or being attracted to more than the other. So I got into a master's program, Masters of Law at UVic. John Burroughs ended up being my supervisor there for that. And then once you go down that path, academia or, you know, academic studies, if you want to teach or be a professor in a law school, you, for the most part now, also need a PhD. So continued on from the master's to do a PhD at Osgoode Law School, which is at York University in Toronto. So yeah, went on to do that, and kind of, as I've been saying, you know, focusing on similar questions, like what is percentage law, you know, in the master's being a smaller project, a more narrow instance. I looked at that fuel spill that happened at Goldstream River and how, kind of trying to think about what that would mean and look like from a percentage law perspective. And then in my PhD, it, you know, I broadened out to think of a bit more of a broader view of what percentage law is, how it works, how do we think about its revitalization in terms of colonialism, climate crisis, and whatnot, like I mentioned earlier. So yeah, that's sort of my path through education and how I got here. And then once you're in at a university in academic studies, it's just you learn that PhD is not your life work. That's kind of what gets you in the door. And now it's what I try and spend most of my time thinking about and trying to learn about and to help push forward, I guess, in how I can. So that looks different in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's field school things. Sometimes it's showing different things to other people through writing or what have you. And so that's how I've ended up where I am mostly, I suppose. So UBC has been a good fit for me. I still live over here at Sayout. So it's when I do teach in Vancouver, it's not an ideal commute to work, but I make it work for the most part. So a lot of the work that gets done in this field is to think about the question of how might Canadian law and Indigenous law. So, I mean, obviously across British Columbia, Canada, there are tons of different Indigenous legal orders or traditions that might be similar in some senses, but obviously come from their own different cultures, rootedness in place and what have you. So they look very, very different. So there's not really any one answer, but a lot of times what people become interested in is then how do we get either one, how do we make space within Canadian law to uphold or implement Indigenous laws? Sometimes that's the question, or how do we have these two work together? I suppose as I've come to think about it, and this is just my own work and kind of opinion on it now, or the more that I've been studying it, is that I don't actually make that my foundational question anymore. And that's sort of, I step a bit back from that to not just assume Canadian law. Because after a certain amount of time in law school, like absent maybe, depending on how you interpret treaty or what have you, I don't actually have yet to be overly convinced of any kind of legitimate authority for Canadian law in this place other than sheer oppression or colonialism or however you want to put it. It kind of does like this backwards legitimizing, but in terms of like how it arrives in the original instances and then how it courts and governments and whatnot are here now, that I don't necessarily start there as my starting point in terms of fitting one into the other. It's not entirely clear to me that you can fit one into the other, in that if they come, maybe we'll get into it. It takes a lot more discussion and talking through, but also, once you start to look at and think of law as not just a set of rules or a system of rules, but a cultural phenomenon that flows from a particular way of seeing and understanding the world, your place within the world, maintaining relationships and what have you within that, that once you have two very different orientations to begin with, Canadian law and percentage or what have you, any other Indigenous legal order, that it becomes very difficult to just think about how do you then just fit one into the other without at that point presuming already sovereignty, property, all of these other things that Canadian law for a large part rests upon or kind of hinges upon, carries with it a very particular way. Like sovereignty, while you might think of it as in any number of different ways, it, you know, tends to relate back to this territorial conception of having dominion or complete authority over an area. Some do try and talk about how you can have Indigenous sovereignty or other sorts of things to try and kind of stretch the concept. But also, if you start from another place where we might think about water, other more than human beings within the territory as not being something that we're sovereign over, but rather you take a relational lens all the way down that we're in relation with all of these other beings in place. And you see, I guess, agency and being in these other salmon people and the waters and the land itself and so forth, it becomes very difficult to kind of bridge that in a way that doesn't require distorting, making certain assumptions about the other. But the other part of it in which I started to think more about is that, I mean, so one, that's the colonialism side of things, but there's also the climate crisis side of things too, right? That I think once you start to look at climate, the reality is that we're not in very good shape right now, right? That all of the international panels and other sorts of things saying that we need drastic and far-reaching changes in economic, social, cultural, legal structures and what have you, or in other words, that the status quo as it is, which is kind of forged out of global colonialisms, racial hierarchies, capitalisms, what have you, is doing a great deal of harm, not just to people, subjugated groups, but to those more than human relatives that we speak of as well. And a lot of nature is seen as something separate, right? As resource or to be extracted and relied upon and appropriated and what have you. So once you see kind of Canadian law and that it fits within this kind of global order or what have you, and the amount of change that's required to that to imagine some more type of just future, or perhaps even for many things, a future whatsoever. Basically, I tend to think of it as that we need to be doing things a whole lot differently than we are. And so then assuming that what gets carried forward is sovereignty, property, all of these other things that I mentioned that already take as their worldview or starting point, that nature is something outside of this. Like, this would be a long discussion, but the way that sovereignty, for instance, is theorized is dates back to justifying early colonial expansion that saw Indigenous peoples as savage and part of nature and what have you, and property as being, you know, to make it your own, you take it in, approve upon it, and a lot of complex theoretical things, right? But they're not just neutral subjects or ideas or concepts. They're doing a lot of work that is, one, has caused and continues to perpetuate these types of harms, right? So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying that once we think of colonialism as a kind of ongoing structure and climate crisis as something that needs to be addressed, but it's not just kind of a thing out there, but rests on a particular way of understanding how the world is organized, thought of, treated and whatnot, that it makes more sense to me to not try and then just think about how do we fit Saanich law, Indigenous law into something that's already there, but more so what would we need to do to imagine a different future that is anti-colonial, that doesn't try to just continue on with what we have, but is something that would be far better and more just, I suppose. And for me, that means what needs to change a whole lot more is Canadian law, nation state law, and what have you, more so than Indigenous systems of law. And so them fitting one into the other, for instance, or having one, if we think of reconciliation, you can mean reconciliation in a lot of different ways. But sometimes people say something like finding a compromise between the two or what have you. Rarely do they ask from which starting point. Usually they mean now, when compromise now between when reserve lands are what, 0.2% and Indigenous jurisdiction has been overtly oppressed and what have you, right? So, I mean, going way back, compromise, it's a problematic starting point, I guess is what I'm getting at. I guess one way you might think of it is there's a lot of layering of things. It's not as though there's just kind of like a one moment where everything's just sort of switched over. You have this kind of constant layering and shifting of things. One thing that I found helpful recently in reading a book of Chiri Pasternak, who I really like, if you think of just in terms of jurisdiction, right? So jurisdiction is like the ability to speak the law or to have, you know, maybe authority over is not the exactly right word, but to speak to what laws will apply in that area. So we might think of that in terms of the 13 moons, or if our Nakhimit, where we have different family connections to certain fishing locations or hunting grounds or what have you, that there already was a system of law and jurisdiction in this area. For instance, the soft borders between us and Lekwungen, or Couch and Lummi and what have you, and how it is that we lived and interacted in these areas among people and others, right? But then you start to get this process of layering over. Like, lots of people will speak now about the international border, you know, through Saanich territory, and that restricts one movement in and across that for us easily, but also does a lot of other things, right? So more recently, there's been efforts to try and protect Ktlalmachan, southern resident killer whales, right? But if you have Canada trying to do one thing and the States trying to do another thing, it's these invisible lines. The orcas don't know about these invisible lines that are out there, right? But those levels of drawing lines create a lot of different tensions, right? Same with, I had a group of students trying to think about how do we restore shellfish beds in terms of if people would go out and harvest clams to eat, and now we have basically blanket closures over almost all shellfish harvesting beds. I forget what they ended up saying, but something like 17 different bodies or something like that, that speak law to this, right? You have municipalities, provincial, federal, but you also within federal have parks, departments of fisheries and oceans, transportation, and what have you. When they try and make the marine conservation area out here that they were thinking of, it's that, you know, if you have the ship tanking traffic going by, that's, you know, shipping, and then you have these other marinas that are all these other complex things. And so you get this very entangled web of colonial laws and jurisdictions and what have you, that I guess Shiri spoke of it as like kind of like choke out sometimes, or like lay over, and then it becomes very hard to see through or to then get at those other layers that were already there about our Nahimit, our family, our other sorts of things, right? A lot of that gets, you know, got done with reserve creations too, early reserve creation here. Cole Harris wrote this great book called Making Native Space, and his son, Doug Harris, who I work with at UBC, wrote a book called Landing Native Fishery, and talks about how these two different kind of regimes start to draw more lines like that, right? Like 0.2% or point whatever percent of reserve lands gets hived off while it opens up everything else, right? So just like these layers after layers of reserve creation, Indian Act, and all of these other things. So, I mean, in terms, and depending on the level of detail that you would go into that, it becomes very hard to kind of explore, because it's different in each place too, right? There are the big overarching things in terms of the claim to sovereignty, like I mentioned, about being however you want to cast it, which goes all the way back to 1600s and papal bulls and saying, yes, we can colonize the world because these others are savages, and all these sorts of justifications. But then in places, very specific places, each one looks a little bit different, right, in terms of the airport or the ferries or what have you, and how it is that these particular things got hived off and used for certain purposes, the Malahat Highway, and then they become important and things get bundled up around them. So another term that gets used is critical infrastructure, right? Like, so now when you see things like Tsoatin or Trans Mountain Pipeline or other things, like these things get talked about as being critical for Canada as a nation state. So that the type of jurisdictional, regulatory, police, courts, all of this kind of get lumped around it to protect that, because that's what fosters and perpetuates Canada as a nation state, but as a colonial nation state too, right? Like that's the ongoing continual reproduction of colonialism, colonial hierarchies and what have you. So in one, you can point to certain things that say how Canadian law has done these, but it always looks a bit different in different places and different times and in different ways. So if I was to do a full circle back to think about how I came into academics rather than working in Canadian law, is that there's a lot of people, maybe not a lot of people, but there are, I think, convincing arguments about how colonialism works, that if we go back a certain amount of time, you saw much more outwardly racist, exclusionary, oppressive, you know, you can't leave the reserve without a pass type things. Indigenous people couldn't have lawyers, other sorts of things like that, that you cannot do X, right? Like, so working specifically through exclusion, that there's others now that point to more, I guess you might call it, insidiary ways that colonialism works through inclusion, right? That when you get pushed into Canadian law, Aboriginal law, that yes, you can get important victories in legal cases, I guess you might say, sometimes you might uphold important rights or what have you, but also as a general trajectory or stream of things, that just like the modern day treaty process, for instance, like if you see what Cowichan's working on that next door, it's like, okay, well, I think what it is, maybe 85-90%, like give up claim, outright claim to 85-90% of your territory right off the bat, and then we'll talk about the other bit, about how we compromise, about how your treaty might work in these areas in terms of whatnot. And that'll be structured along a kind of liberal democratic thing that means you have to have XYZ in place and what have you. So this process of inclusion, same with what you might get protected in Aboriginal laws, you get funneled down a certain path that's already presuming, like if I go back to talk about a very particular way of seeing the world, understanding the world and what have you, you get funneled deeper and deeper into that. And it limits how far outside of that you might ever be able to get. So if you start off by saying, I actually have a very fundamentally different thing that I want to say and uphold and protect, is that I have a very particular understanding and relationship with Tsleil-Waututh, first ancestor, water, rain, and what have you, and to protect that, and you try and go to court to protect that or what have you, it's what happened for me is I lost a lot of, I don't see Section 35 or Canadian law as being any type of answer to getting me to anywhere where I want or hope to get, I suppose. In fact, often I see it as being quite the opposite, that you become, I don't know, millions and millions and millions of dollars in debt over the span of fighting for 30 years to get a very truncated type of something in the end, which doesn't actually, we go back to the climate thing and the other sort of thing, actually solve much of what you set out to do with in the first place. So I try not to be just like a big downer on it, but I try to spend more time thinking about if we took these other things that Saanich Law has often talked about and tried to uphold, these other types of relationships. It would be somewhat of an equally hard question to say, what is Saanich Law in a nutshell, just like it would be with Canadian law, and that there's lots of different elements and understandings and aspects to it. But for one, I suppose I see it as being a lot more decentralized in the sense it's like we didn't have a state or what have you, and so law existed in kind of different ways. Also coming from an oral tradition, I tend to look to things like stories and other ways that you might carry teachings, laws forward, right? The way that I have come to think about ours is that we have a lot of different stories for it's being very kind of place-based, I suppose. It's either tied to beings more than human beings that move in and through Saanich territory, so multiple stories about Tsleil-Waututh, deer or salmon or what have you, but also stories tied very particular to places. And not far from us, people will often talk about the story of Tsleil-Waututh, about how we became, or when we said we would become known as the Saanich or the emerging people. That when you have stories that are very tied to or rooted into place in that way, that I think is very important to Saanich law, because Canadian law doesn't really work like that, right? Like Canadian law and liberal constitutionalism is trying to have an idea of individual freedom and this can come and apply over here and what have you, like presents itself as universal. But once you start to root in place like that and to focus on relationship, that I think that place has a very important role. So we might think of islands too, that when you say I could go into each of the stories. I don't know. I know we're in a series of podcasts here, and we've probably had others who've spoken about these stories. But we think about Tlaeches, or relatives of the Deep Islands, who were thrown out by Chaos when they were created out into the ocean and were given the law, I would say, about to look after the Kwisanich people, and that we would in turn look after them, that you have this kind of broad orientation about being in good relationship with islands. But each of the islands are different and have had different things happen. Tlaltos, James Island, set dynamite factory on it, golf courses and what have you. So I often say it like this, what it means to be in good relation is always context specific, right? Like, you wouldn't say, what does it mean to be a good wife, husband, parent, partner, what have you, by just saying, oh yeah, you just do this or whatever, right? Sometimes it requires listening. Sometimes it requires nudging. Sometimes it requires hugging. Sometimes it's not, like, there is no, it's not, when people hear the word relationship, sometimes they just think, oh, that's just some romantic whatever. It's like, no, it's, once you think of relationships all the way down, about what does it mean for me in this moment, in this context, with all that's going on, to be in good relationship with another, is a very difficult question, right? Like, it creates a range of things you might do, which is also, not to get too theoretical again, but that's why I say it's decentralized as well, right? Like, when you take in that story and make it a part of you, it's not written down somewhere over here, right? I think that Kwisanich law is carried in our culture, community, and stories, but it's also carried right here inside of us, right? Like, you internalize it and you make it a part of you. Like, all law has that kind of subjective part of it in some ways or another, but it becomes very prevalent in oral traditions, I think, because that's how you carry it forward. And then that's also why people will say a very similar story, but sometimes emphasize different things and certain tellings or what have you, because that's just how it works, or depending on what's being focused on in that aspect. So, I mean, I think that we've done lots of things. I mean, although we have the Supreme Court claim for James Island right now, and I've already said how Canadian law is not my preferred means of things. Like, sometimes you get pushed into doing things that are, okay, if we actually have an obligation here, like, yes, that is using Canadian law, but one way of trying to uphold that responsibility that we have to care for that island, right? Because that dispossession that's happened through property and other sorts of things that we talked about, how you cannot walk past the high watermark now without that being trespassing, right? That responsibility or law to care for that place and to be in relation to that place has been taken away. So it's a dispossession in one sense, like a physical, it's been taken, stolen. It's a dispossession in another sense, that our laws, our responsibilities and obligations have also been flattened over and taken away, that we cannot go to that place and uphold their laws and obligations anymore. But we do it the best that we can. I think that when that paddle for Tlaltos was arranged, we went out and paddled around the island. I wrote about how I think that in itself was one aspect of upholding Kwisanich law. It said that we're still here, that we remember this obligation and relationship, and we're still fighting for that, right? That's part of that being in relationship. There's a lot of barriers there that we can't just take that island back, I guess you might say. That's part of it, right? So that whole land back thing is, there's a lot of layers to that too, right? Because land back, even if you get it back, that layering of jurisdiction and stuff that I've mentioned is so complicated that Sisquenum came back this, but you got to put environmental covenants on it and do all of these other things, or it can look all bunch of different ways, but it's hard to disentangle all of that that colonialism that's there, I suppose. So one thing that I do is I very much try and honor and carry forward what I've been privileged enough to have elders share with me, right? So I try and take that and to make that at the root of what I do. And then to try and think about, okay, well, how do I explain this to people who are in law that understand law in a certain type of way? And then say, okay, well, our law looks like this and here's how it's different. So I, you know, then I get into talking about things in a kind of theoretical-ish type of way, I guess. So it becomes like a hard balance for me to try and walk between those two, because on the one hand, it's that people take different approaches in Indigenous law. So not everybody who does Indigenous law work will it explain it in the way that I explain it. Some take more of approach that you can look to stories to actually kind of take out laws, or that there's laws kind of embedded in stories that way. Whereas when I speak of stories as always being, I guess I talk of them as just always being like a snapshot of a particular time and telling, and that they're pointing to relationships that then you then live and are always kind of moving and dynamic. And so it's not about just like searching for a particular rule, but more so trying to take that in and make it part of you, I suppose. There are differences in the way that people doing this type of work that I do go about that. But I suppose I always try and honor and follow what elders have said, that they're always kind of pointing back to, here's our stories, here's our beliefs. Like I think you have interviewed Jacinctin, and you know, he'll often say to when we're at government tables, like, here's our beliefs. He's like, we can't let that go. You can't tell us just to get rid of that. And it's, you know, I think it's at a very deep level where it's, well, you could look at it a few ways. Like, it's not even just a refusal. I don't think he just means it as like, we could give that up, but we're not going to. You shouldn't ask us to. I think it's actually also a level of like, you actually cannot, like, you actually just cannot do that. That it's seeing that these relationships are there, whether you acknowledge them or not, right? Like, Canadian law tends to try and look at things in a kind of compartmentalized sort of way. In other words, like a narrowing down to the law works this way in this instance or what have you. Whereas I tend to see things, or tend to try and look at Wasinich law as like an opening up. Now, once you start to talk about one relationship, there's all of these other relationships too, and it kind of moves in the opposite way. And you know, I kind of say it jokingly sometimes to people who don't get it, or are maybe used to something like this. But when I talked about that fuel spill at Goldstream, and I came to ask Jacinctin about it, and he started telling me about Smythe and islands and all of these other things. And it's, at the time, you know, you can think, I don't know, maybe struggle in some sense of like, okay, how do deer and islands relate to the fuel spill at Goldstream in a way that's, you know, and I don't even think I went in with as narrow a conception as law as some might, but some might think, okay, well, that's not even, you might even just think that that's not relevant or what have you, right? But that, I guess that's that opening up, that once you start teaching about relationality as a first starting point, right? So I guess I tend to think of it as like, and I take this from Kevin Paul, who was another one of my teachers. He wrote about this, about Tlaxen or mallard. He says, like, if you say mallard in English, it brings to mind the image of a duck. But Tlaxen and Earth knows about when that duck come to Wasinich territory at a particular time of year, and they're with their beaks to the ground like this. Earth knows when they're eating grain, which is when they're best to hunt and eat. And then we use feathers in ceremony, and that, so this this expanding out of this word, right? Same with Kleitches, which relatives to the deep, and then the story, and it expands outwards, right? So I think that it's, so I oft, he talks about that as creating participants, that the Sinchothan language creates participants, that to truly understand the full depth of meaning of the word Tnuxen or Kleitches or what have you, you become a participant in that relationship. And I suppose I took that and I borrowed that to try and say, well, that is what stories are doing too, that each story is not, you know, you don't just take, here's the one story that was written down and you have that, and you take the law out and then that's the law forever here on forward. I mean, you can have some aspects of things that are contained in that way, but I tend to look at it, it's like, okay, that's the snapshot, one telling at one time, but it's really pointing to these other layers of relationships that are in these stories. And then it's up to you to go out to try and take that in, to live and to continually be a part of that, to see yourself in relation to all of these other things that are going on. So I guess that's when I think of it as being a bit more decentralized, because there's not one right way to do that, right? It looks a bit different for everybody. And that's just kind of the nature of it. I think there's a bound of, you have stories about being in bad relationship too, right? And then certain corrections to behaviors or what have you. You're not free to just do anything, I suppose. But yeah, so I think when I go back to what Sinkton was teaching me when I asked about Goldstream, I think step one was like, was that, right? Like, it was like, okay, see relationally and see yourself in this, in all of these different ways. And then it shifted the way that the questions that I asked about that spill. It wasn't just like, okay, how does Sinich Law respond to and fix this spill then, for instance? It was more like, okay, well, what was even the harm that happened here then? Because Canadian law, it was that fuel spill went in, you clean up the oil, fish die, you put more fish in, and what have you. Well, Sinich Law, that's ceremonial bathing location, and we talk about Tsleil-Waututh, first ancestors meant to wash us, wake us, strengthen us when we go do bathing ceremony and other things. So it becomes, what you're responding to even becomes seen in a different way. And then so how you go about doing it becomes different. So I think that was something that those two taught me, and I'm obviously still learning. But that's what I try to do. I guess when I say I try to honor that and carry that forward, it's also, I borrowed this from Kevin Paul, but that's why I named my dissertation, The Old People Are the Song and We Are Their Echo, because that's the way that echoes work, right? Like, you have the voice that goes out, but it's always reverberating back based on context and other things. It's this kind of dynamic interplay. I don't know. There's something just about it when he wrote that down, or that came from a dream that he had, I guess, and he shared those words, and I was like, that's, I don't know, it just meant something for me, and I tried to capture that, I suppose. I have a son, he's 7 now. There is something about having, being a parent, that you start to see the world in a different way. I don't know, it's maybe, at least for me anyways, like, it was hard to, not see it in a different way. I remember thinking that coming back from the hospital, actually, when I was driving, and I was kind of like going pretty slow, I guess, and careful. And I was like, everyone's just rushing around still. And I was like, doesn't everyone know the world has just like fundamentally changed? It was like, it seemed so different to me. The world just looked and seemed different. And I was just like, for everyone else, the world's like the same as that they do every day, just rushing through it. And me, I was like, no, this is somehow, this day is from here on out is just different. I couldn't really explain why. And even just having a kid in general felt pretty hard with the climate stuff. As things are going now, there's a big part of me that is very scared and worried that his life, and should he have children, their life might just be not very good at all, right? Like, the world might be a very, very bad place or difficult place, depending on how things go and whatnot. And that's just so sad. Like, who am I, right? Like, I can't change the world. I'd have no illusions that I can change the world in any, like, on that level of things. But also, maybe it's like that responsibility thing, like I talked about with islands and or other things, like that having a son, it's like, well, or being a parent, it's like, well, how can I not do whatever it is that I can try to do to say, like, this has to be different? Like, it just has to be. Like, I don't, sometimes I have a hard time understanding people in the world and the things that get done. And as they go on, it's just like, I don't understand how we just obviously don't see things, and like we're not even from the same planet almost or something. It's just like so hard to comprehend. But how you create that level of change is such a hard question, both structurally and I guess like subjectively, like in people at that level. I think the field school tries to do that in terms of, I think it touches people on that internal level. Like we go out into the ocean on day one. If we're going to talk about water and slum, it's like, we're not just going to talk about it. We're going to go into the cold ocean and we're going to feel water and we're going to look at the tankers out there and we're going to try and think about it in terms of what this actually means and then what is actually at stake if you think about it in that way. But yeah, like global change is something very hard to think through and to try and actualize, I guess. But what the future would look like, I mean, I think a lot of my project, the revitalization of Indigenous law, what have you, I mean, because there's lots of different ones and I'm not trying to make a Kucinich world order or something like that, right? That there are different bounds of things that different Indigenous traditions across the globe that don't speak of things fundamentally differently, really, right? Like when I was in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and you hear Maori speak about their laws and traditions, and I was like, would never have met each other, but like I can understand the laws that you're speaking about in a way that makes a whole lot more sense than Canadian law to me still, because they talk about it from a similar kind of, to borrow like a word from Aaron Mills, who works in this field as well, like a rooted, he talks about it as a rooted constitutionalism, like something that comes out of that relationality, I suppose. So even though the laws and systems and governance and all of that might look a bit different in terms of how they organize that, that there's still kind of like this rooted element that you can look and say, okay, I understand that, and that can work over here and this can work over here, and it all makes sense. But I think what I've started to see and realize more is that, and this goes to the global thing too, right? That it's not just, I'm not talking about climate change in just like an abstract kind of way either. It's also that there's another type of dispossession or harm that's happening from the lens of Kucinich law, right? When you think about acidification of oceans or there's CO2 in the atmosphere equally here as opposed to anywhere else, then that's one of those threads of relation that we don't always see, right? Like, it doesn't matter to me that oil, fossil fuel, whatever else is being burnt over there. That's not just some law for territorial bound state X or whatever, that is creating impacts in the airs, waters, trees, and everything here that is a violation of Kucinich law, as far as I'm concerned. And that is something that I should be able to speak to regardless of whether I live, am, or am from there or what have you, that is having impacts everywhere, right? So it's really trying to think through what are those deep structural things and what are they doing in places here too, and why does that matter? That no longer does that, it never worked, but no longer does that narrative work that colonialism has always done, that's away and out of sight and is something else, right? Like that's not, when we think of that, there is no more away like that anymore. There never was, but now it's just now, I think, perfectly obvious that just isn't the case and that they can't work that way. So, I mean, one thing that I think about is, like, I think you interviewed Mandy Belinda Celilia with this, and she talks a lot about the 13 moons and how it's climate change is, I don't know, you might say disrupted or what have you, that used to, like, one example she'll talk about is how the blooming of ocean spray would trigger indicate the peak of the sockeye run, which then move into the first salmon ceremony and all kinds of other law and governance type things, but that now that when ocean spray blooms doesn't necessarily exactly correlate with when the peak of the sockeye salmon run is here. But to me anyways, that doesn't it's not what she's saying either. It doesn't mean that the 13 moons calendar or governance structure is broken, right? You could actually look at it as showing that it's working very well, that it's still that process of seeing and acknowledging these different indicator species and relations, and that very form of governance and observation is pointing to something that we know in other ways now too, that something funky is going on here, right? Like these impacts are causing strains and different reactions in relationships. Then it becomes the question then of, then what do you do? How does that influence our actions or decision making, right? Because it's never just that, okay, this is happening and then we're powerless or whatever. It's that there is always that agency and law that you make. The law is always making that choice about, well, here's how that is going to impact and then direct our actions, decision making, and other sorts of things, right? So you might just as easily, I mean, it's just another form of our science, right? That you might have science panels saying climate change is a thing and we need to do things differently. And so then that impacts your, should impact your decision making about then how your laws and actions happen. It's like, well, that's just what our 13 moons calendar is saying. And then that impacts how we do it. So it's, it's that there's that shifting that happens. And then you're kind of constantly regulating your decisions and actions from there, I suppose. And then, I mean, things change at another kind of level as well, right? I mean, for me, I'll often personally think about it, and maybe others have, I've heard others do as well, that a lot of times, you know, the story of Slamuk, first ancestors being the first man who came to the earth in the form of rain. But I've started often just saying the first ancestor or first person, because I mean, there's gendered aspects to that too, right? Where it's, you might want to ask, like, why is it the, we have different stories that involve women and all kinds of other things, stories that maybe aren't gendered at any way, or all kinds of other elements, at least in things are the way that I think about it now, is that it's at least I tend to leave it open, or sometimes I'll say it one way and then another way, and I'll see how students react. It's like, okay, well, what do you think? Did you notice that one time I said, here's the first Kusanish man as our ancestor, and then another time I said this, and what does that mean to you? What does that make you think? Why is it that way? And so it's not like we can't bring a critical lens or ask questions about Kusanish law as well, like we might of Canadian law or any other legal tradition, of saying that things were this way once, is it still that way now? Or what does this mean for how we view the way we relate to each other, or all kinds of other questions, right? Like I think we can ask those questions and to reflect on those things, and what does it mean and what does it look like, particularly given, you know, the Indian Act and colonialism and other things has done a lot of things along gendered lines too, where you couldn't pass status along as being an Indigenous woman. You couldn't, all kinds of things like that, right? So even just within that context, does it add an extra kind of layer or reason or incentive to say, okay, well, this is, what if we tell the story this way now instead? What does that look like or mean or influence? So things change in that way as well. And that's part of that agency, right? Like, I don't know, I just decided, like, it's obviously just me telling, I know other people do too, might tell the story one way and one time a different way. So it's part of telling a story, is that they're always a bit different each time, and then you keep taking from it. So just one example, I'm sure there are many others. Thanks for having me, and never really sure how I just start talking, and I'm never really sure how it's going to go, but I'm glad that it's hopefully something useful and helpful in there. And I spent a fair amount of time trying to think about that dynamic or play between fluidity and rootedness, or like that change and the way that things are. I mean, I guess because we have like our chilang and like our ancestry or birthright and that, and that this anchoring in place too with all of these different stories, but that even in that very deep rootedness, that there is that fluidity or change or dynamic aspect. So we often think of like a deep kind of like rootedness or stability, and then change, fluidity, as being like two opposite things. But there's almost like this way that I try and think of or understand how it's that you can have both, I guess, at the same time, that there's kind of like that rootedness, even though while we're always in kind of a dynamic type of thing. And that's just coming back to trying to make sense of when Kevin told me the old people know the song and we are their echo, that it's like that you still have, that you have that song even while we're like echoing around. And that could be part of my academic thing too, where people speak of cultural essentialism and all of these other things today, where you're like, you can't, you know, it's not about, or that indigenous law is just trying to return to the past or something that once was or what have you. And me constantly saying like, no, I'm not talking about returning to the past, that yes, I'm grabbing on to something that my elders and others went through a whole lot to be able to hold on to and to continue passing on. But that doesn't mean that what I'm talking about is going to be exactly the same. It's that we constantly make the choice and the decision to hold on to that and to bring it forward into what we do each time. So it's always dynamic too, that it's both that rootedness and that fluidity in the same moment, I guess. So it's another hard thing to explain to people or to like try and emphasize, because people always think you're just trying to go back, and it's not what any of this is about. It's also why I've been talking about climate in the future and what you want things to look like. You ask me what I want things to look like for my son or for others. It's, I guess it's carrying some of that forward. And I just try and do my the best I can with what's been, like I said, honored enough to be shared with me, and that I try to carry forward as best I can until hopefully someone else one day carries it too.
Thank you very much to Robert for doing this interview. This interview and the entire series has been made possible with funding from the Capital Regional District, the Pender Island Community Resource Center, the Wasanich Leadership Council, Wasanich School Board, the Pender Islands Museum, and the South Pender Historical Society. Thank you to all these organizations for contributing to make these recordings possible.